Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, where we feature community conversations around South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel throughout our community and listen to local groups discuss what matters to them. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Ammon Swenson. Today's show comes from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's 2026 Economic Forecast Luncheon. The event features a presentation on key sectors of Anchorage's economy and what the future holds for jobs and demographics. More information can be found on aedcweb.com. We'll start with the tail end of the report and then hear keynote speaker Mark C. Pernas talk called Education with Purpose and Employment with Passion. The event was recorded at the Denina Center on January 28th and was edited for broadcast.
And we just keep seeing growth in the transportation employment. In 2025, this sector added another 550 jobs, right alongside that cargo volume growth. A lot of these new jobs were in what's called last mile delivery service, such as courier services or local delivery from Amazon Prime and big box stores. We don't see that growth stopping yet, and we are forecasting another 450 jobs in the transportation sector in 2026. And now we'll look at healthcare. The largest of the sectors we'll talk about today, it is also the most complicated. While it's certainly considered a household expense for most people, as well as for companies who pay a portion of insurance premiums for their employees, the number one driver of healthcare growth in Alaska is government spending. In 2025, we saw additional growth in this large industry, with 900 jobs added. This growth was despite the uncertainty around federal healthcare spending and the repeal of pandemic-era subsidies for healthcare marketplace plan premiums. It was also in spite of some layoffs at larger employers in town. What we're seeing is continued expansion in areas such as behavioral health and skilled nursing. With new facilities in these two areas opening next year, laid-off healthcare jobs will most likely be offset by new jobs, and more jobs are going to be created. Anchorage will need to continue creating and attracting a strong healthcare workforce to keep filling these needs. The expiration of pandemic-era enhanced subsidies for Affordable Care Act marketplace health insurance plans will result in increased monthly premiums for all Alaskans who use the ACA marketplace. In 2024, there were 9,300 Anchorage residents enrolled through the ACA marketplace. The average premium for all individuals enrolled will increase this year by an average of $153 per month. However, if we're to look at specific household and income compositions, those changes can, of course, be much higher. Here on the screen, what you're seeing is an example of a family of four with two 40-year-old adults and two teenage children. For this family, in 2025, premiums would have been $603 per month. Without the enhanced subsidies, which again expired last year, this family will now be paying $1,001 per month, or $12,000 per year, in premiums, an increase of $400 per month and $5,000 a year. For a family with a household income of $120,000, this is, of course, a substantial increase. It's worth noting that the reason most people are on the healthcare marketplace is because they are self-employed and do not have employer-based health plans. Those on the marketplace have incomes that are too high to qualify for Medicaid, but they cannot buy into a group plan through an employer. In aggregate, the loss of these subsidies, healthcare subsidies to Alaska through the marketplace, is going to result in a decrease of $43 million coming to Anchorage in 2026.
When we think about the oil and gas industry, the industry has really contended with a challenging price environment over the last year as they've made some very significant investments in Alaska, particularly on the North Slope. Those two different themes are really well depicted in the chart you're seeing on the screen here. What you can see on the screen is that in the bar chart, we have average production per day on the North Slope and average Alaska North Slope price in the line chart. If we were to look at a similar chart for a different producing region, maybe in the lower 48, what you would expect to see is that production would fluctuate to a much greater extent based on price. In Alaska, the nature of our environment and our infrastructure is such that these companies really can't turn on and off production as they see those prices fluctuate. So that's why what you're seeing in the history part of this forecast, or excuse me, of this chart, is they're really not moving in tandem very much. I also want to draw your attention to the forecast piece of this chart. As I mentioned, oil and gas companies have been making very serious and significant investments here in Alaska. And that's going to show up in the forecast for production in our state. You can see this year we anticipate higher production on the North Slope as Santos's Pikka project moves into its production phase. Just beyond this forecast period, around 2030, we also anticipate seeing ConocoPhillips' Willow project start producing, and that will increase output on the North Slope as well. In contrast to that, oil prices are expected to continue to face those challenges, especially in the near term, as we've already seen over the last several months. There could be additional downside price risk here in the near term if supply changes, for example, from new Venezuelan production, or if OPEC changes targets. Against that backdrop of a really challenging price environment, we've seen layoffs in the oil and gas industry that have impacted employment here in Anchorage. In the coming year, we anticipate that overall oil and gas employment in Anchorage will be lower. What I really like to point out about this chart is that what you're seeing here is average annual employment based here in Anchorage. So this is when your job is located right here. There is another segment of people in Anchorage that live here in our community. Maybe they live in Anchorage or the Mat-Su, and they work on the Alaska North Slope in the oil and gas industry. That's not represented here, though they do bring their wages back to our communities and spend their money locally. So as those new fields come into production in the coming years, should there be more employment on the North Slope, we often feel that positive economic impact as those residents are employed there. Moira and I have not yet talked today about the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Pipeline project, though it's really had some renewed energy in the past year. You've likely heard majority owner Glenn Farn speaking about this. You've likely seen lots of announcements about engineering cost estimates, and last week some conditional awards of construction bids. There is no FID yet on this project, though of course our firm and our team is following it eagerly. Should there be a positive final investment decision on this Alaska LNG pipeline, you could expect that the population forecast and the employment forecast that we've already gone over would substantially change. Finally, we'll talk a little bit about construction today. First, I'll give you an overview of some of what's happening in construction right here within Anchorage. We'll talk a little bit about how that relates to the rest of Alaska and wrap up with an employment forecast. We so appreciate Bill from the mayor's team being here today, although he stole some of my talking points, so maybe this will really sink in. Over the last year, we saw the number of residential units permitted in Anchorage really go up, especially after some historic lows in the last few years. That's been driven primarily by increases in multifamily units. So you can think about this like the number of duplexes, triplexes, and all the way on up. You can really see an increase in the number of units added. And that's especially significant given that we still have those interest rates that are a little higher. And when I say a little higher, I do mean that. Mortgage rates, last I looked on the Department of Labor website, were about 6%. So this isn't an outrageous interest rate if you think about the history of residential lending in Alaska, but that increase that happened really rapidly is very much sticking in folks' minds. On the commercial side, you've also heard this from Bill and others today, that we have several large commercial projects happening in Anchorage. We've got redevelopment downtown at the 4th Avenue Marketplace, groundbreaking of Alaska Cargo and Cold Storage out at the Anchorage Airport. We heard a lot about the port modernization program with the first terminal going in. If you've been on the Alaska Native Medical Center campus recently, you should also have noted that there's a large South Central Foundation behavioral health facility being built, and also the ANTHC skilled nursing facility. So this residential and commercial activity and many other projects are going to contribute to our forecast of permitting value activity in the coming year. You should think about this chart and the dollar value represented as the total dollar value of construction put in place here in Anchorage. Over the last several years, we have seen historic highs in that dollar value. And of course, we've seen this residential and commercial construction contribute to that. We've also seen inflation really change the price of building materials. So that's pushing some of these to new highs as well. In the coming year, We don't anticipate, of course, building prices to go down. So we still are seeing fairly high price environment, and we're seeing that level of activity, and we expect higher permit values in the coming year. So we just talked a lot about things happening right here in Anchorage. I like to remind folks that construction activity and projects statewide in Alaska really impact the level of employment that is recorded for the Anchorage construction industry. And here's what that generally looks like. There are many construction firms that are based here in Anchorage. So they have this headquarters here, and they might be deploying crews throughout the state on this short-term basis or for specific projects. So often that work can end up getting counted in our employment figures. What we're seeing in the last several years, you can see those high years of employment that have really been boosted by those infrastructure investments on the North Slope, by significant federal funding coming in through the inflation investment. Let's just call it IIJA. I don't remember what that stands for anymore, but I hope you do. Through IIJA, all of that coming in and really boosting employment. What we saw over the summer, because again, this is annual average, generally, our construction season is highest in the summer, and we saw the number of jobs in 2024 and 2025 really go up to that 10,000 mark in the last couple of years. That hasn't happened for about a decade. So that's what's been happening in that sector. As we see one of those large projects coming to a close on the North Slope, there may be some jobs-related impact. Again, these are short-term construction jobs-related impacts here in our Anchorage construction employment. There is a real source of uncertainty in this construction employment, however, and that is the state of Alaska capital budget for transportation. That capital budget for transportation, it really influences the amount of civil construction work that's happening in our state, on our highways, at our airports. But that money is not free. Nothing is free, in fact. And every year, the state has to put up match funding to access that federal stream of funding. In this current fiscal year, the state has not yet appropriated the full match to access that transportation funding. And if that situation is not changed soon, then we have the likelihood to see a jobs impact here. And you can see that in our forecast of construction employment into 2026. We're going to turn over to Heather now, and Heather's going to share with us, as I promised, some Anchorage consumer confidence numbers. Thanks, Heather.
A big thank you to McKinley Research Group and Katie and Moira specifically for helping us present this information. Thank you so much, Katie and Moira, again. So for the past 15 years, AEDC has partnered with Alaska Survey Research, and specifically to track Anchorage's consumer sentiment so we can have a clearer picture about what this looks like right here in our local community. We're often looking at the key similarities and differences about what we might see on a national scale. And typically, a score above 50 indicates optimism, and a score below indicates pessimism. And Anchorage's overall consumer optimism is at 42.8, which is consistent with the national data in that pessimistic category. This is the lowest it's been in the past 10 years. While personal finance confidence is still at an optimistic range, future expectations and local economy confidence are at all-time lows. And if you want to look at this, this is a quarterly report that we provide on our website, a wonderful resource to access and see what does this look like as we move forward into the future quarters. So please visit our website for more in-depth analysis and information there. Today, our goal with our economic forecast presentation has been to provide expectations for what 2026 might look like. And with any forecast, we know that conditions can quickly change throughout the year. If you'd like to stay up on economic trends, that we'd encourage you to focus on these few four areas. First, keep an eye on inflation and consumer confidence to see how leisure, hospitality, and transportation may change. Also, Alaskans, we have long been oil price watchers, so that will continue to be important into 2026. And watch for more announcements about the Alaska LNG project. And again, expect that when an announcement of a FID is announced, this forecast will change. And finally, we're anticipating having more solid data that might impact and help us understand what the changes on those healthcare premiums and enrollees might look like throughout the year. As we transition from the forecast and look to actionable strategies, it's my great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Mark Perna. As you just heard in our forecast, that we continue to be challenged with flat population growth and a shrinking working age population. And for business leaders, that leaves us with a persistent question of how to remain strong and grow when talent is harder to find. Success in Anchorage depends on our market conditions and on how effectively we attract, engage, and develop people, especially the next generation of employers, leaders, and customers. Mark's work as an international speaker, CEO, and generational expert with more than 25 years of experience in his field. He writes weekly for Forbes.com. His podcast, The Perna Syndicate, reaches 70 countries, and his best-selling book, Answering Why, has won 8 national awards. As I read his book and became familiar with his work, I appreciated this message that speaks directly to the goal of building a stronger workforce, healthier communities, and a more resilient economy. We have the opportunity today to evaluate our education systems and workplaces to ensure they are prepared for the next generation to succeed. And this attention is critical at a time when workforce development in our public schools is more important than ever. Let's give Mark a warm welcome.
How many of you, by a show of hands, would like to unleash passion, purpose, and performance in younger generations? Show of hands. Great. As a result of that, how many of you would like to attract and retain more of the right students and employees into the right programs, pathways, classrooms, and careers for all the right reasons? Show of hands. Outstanding. That's what we're going to tend to spend our time talking about today. I'm even going to define the right student and employee anywhere in America today. It's that young person who is motivated. They're dedicated. They see a light at the end of the tunnel for a program, pathway, class, or career, and they actually want to get there. Light at the end of the tunnel is a simple concept. What does their career and lifestyle look like at the light at the end of their tunnel? The tunnel, well, that's the time they spend in education, workforce development, right? It's the work and the labor and the effort and the skill development and the academic rigor. It's everything that's necessary for them simply to feel comfortable enough to take a step and then another step and then another step towards their light at the end of their tunnel. Our challenge in America today, we have way too many young people standing still in the tunnel. They either don't see a light at the end of the tunnel for themselves, or they're afraid to take a step towards something they want, or there could be one or a myriad of things holding them back from being able to take that step. And so what we're going to talk about today is how do we connect, engage, and answer why for younger generations in our sphere of influence. Now, I sit at an interesting intersection. I am a generational expert as my resting pulse, but I'm also an international thought leader on education, workforce development, and economic development. So how we build the pipelines between education, employment is what ultimately serves economic development and the viability of every community, just like Anchorage. And so the ability to connect these dots. Now, I'm going to talk about two generations of people. I'm going to talk about Gen Z followed by Gen Alpha, basically everyone 30 and younger in America. And anytime you do this, it's a huge bell curve. I'm going to be talking about everybody in the middle. There's always outliers to it. But I'm going to work in the time that I have today to connect some dots in this room for you as parents, as educators, as employers, and as community and civic leaders on how we move young people forward and build the pipelines that allow us to thrive as a community. And I'm going to start with a simple thing, and I'm going to take you on this journey. We all think young people are over here, right? We treat them like they're over here. Previous generations were over here. And we're looking at them, and we're thinking to ourselves, why are they not responding the way we want them to in classrooms, in employment, in our homes? It's because they're nowhere near over here. They're all the way over here, 30 and younger in America over here, and they're exceptional over here, and they're creative, and they're intelligent, and they're resourceful, and they're all of these positive things, but we keep treating them like they're over here, and there are some fundamental differences of where they are today that if we simply pivot as communities and recognize that in education, in employment, and how we move forward to build the pipelines, We can keep more of our young people within our communities by recognizing how extraordinary the opportunities are right here in places like Anchorage. And so I'm going to connect these dots, and I'm going to take you on this journey. Look, my presentations come with a warning, and the warning is this. I speak at 120 words a minute with gusts to 210. So I move pretty quickly, and I'm going to jump right in. There is a shifting landscape in education and workforce development in this country right now. Said more plainly, the world's changed. We're in a completely different set of circumstances than we were on Monday. That's how fast the world is shifting and pivoting. And we have to recognize that in this shift, we've got young Americans, 30 and younger, who are trying to figure out how do they fit in our community and what opportunities do they have. I could show you all kinds of, I just recently did a keynote for 450 CEOs of economic development from across mostly North America, some from around the world, and I did a global impact speech, and I'm just using this as a backdrop. You can read these, I'm not reading any of these. But in recognizing that the world is shifting so fast, you just heard so many different stats and ways that you are crushing it in some areas, you obviously need support in other areas, and you're building in other areas, but it's extraordinary that you come together as a community to look and see where are you, how did you get here, but more importantly, how do you take action to move forward? And so we have to recognize that the world's changed in another way. What it takes today in America to build a competitive advantage in all of our lives, but in this case, really the young people in our sphere of influence, is different today than it was in previous generations. We have to recognize the differences and come together as communities to build the kinds of pipelines that fuel meetings like this, that give us the opportunity to reach viability and to excel in a very challenging landscape across America. There are three critical things you have to build a personal competitive advantage in America today. Here they are. The first, robust academic knowledge. My friends, I mean, we have an entire PK, pre-kindergarten through 16, through college system in America that is built and designed to deliver robust academic knowledge, just as critically important today as it was 50 years ago. But here's where the world has shifted. There was a time in America where you could have just robust academic knowledge. In fact, the more robust academic knowledge you had, the more what you would make. Money, right? Some of us were a little bit older. Remember the stair steps? If you had this much education, you made this much, you made this much, you made this. Here's where the world has shifted. No longer necessarily true. Not necessarily untrue, just not necessarily true either. It all depends what your education is in and what the labor market looks like at any given moment. And that is ebbing and flowing that I write about at Forbes every single week. And so we have to recognize that there's now two critical things you have to add to robust academic knowledge. First of these things are technical competencies. Those are the things that you can do in your head and with your hands, right? So whether you want to be a surgeon or an accountant, whether you want to be a programmer or a chef, whether you want to be in auto technology or biotechnology, you have to have the technical abilities to do it. I'll give you a great example. I may have all the academic knowledge to be a surgeon, but the inability to cut somebody open. That's a problem. Right? So you have to be able to marry your academic and your technical together and have them work in concert with each other. The third, my friends, probably the most important is what I call professional and life skills. Things like work ethic, punctuality, leadership, communication, work-life balance, stress management, critical thinking, problem solving, emotional intelligence, networking, flexibility, etc. Yeah. That was a gust. That was a gust. I could add to the list, you could add to the list. These are things in America that we call soft skills, and I changed that term a decade ago because I think the term soft skills makes it sound like they're unimportant, when I think they're the darn near most important things we can give ourselves, not to mention the young people in our sphere of influence. Wall Street Journal would agree. They did a study of CEOs, hiring managers, and human resource executives from across North America and found that 92% of them, 92% valued professional and life skills over academic knowledge and technical competencies. 89% said, man, those are the hardest things for us to find. Well, if they're the hardest things for us to find and we build them in younger generations, what we build in our education system is what comes into our employment and workforce development systems, and this is what allows us to go out and talk to investment and businesses and industries coming into our area to say, yes, you can, in fact, go from 200 employees to 600 employees in this area because we're building competitive advantage, which will tie directly to where you want to go in this extraordinary community. And we have to be able to connect those dots, but we have a problem. Here's the problem we have in America systemically. Systemic education in America, we have this issue. According to a Wall Street Journal study, done, two-thirds of American high school kids in America see no value in going to college and think they'll be just fine without a degree. Two-thirds. You have to juxtapose that against how systemically in education in America, we answer a very relevant question in middle schools and high schools. And the question could have a number of different versions, but the question is this, and it's a reasonable question. Why is any of this important? When am I ever going to use this? Varying degrees on a theme. When you answer this systemically in America, the answer typically has something to do with getting good grades, getting into a good school, having a better life, having more opportunities. Well, if two-thirds of high school kids in America see no value in going to college and getting a degree, we're literally telling two-thirds of high school kids systemically in America, this isn't for you. The second they think it's not for them, this is why one of the reasons that engagement's at an all-time low, hope is at an all-time low in younger generations, mental health issues, challenges, and behaviors that are at an all-time high, and we're trying to figure out how do we build this connection to build relevance to their journey every day. And I'm going to share it with you this way. Why do straight-A 4.0 students in our education system at any level of education, why do straight-A 4.0 students show up every day and do everything we're asking them to do? If we went back and forth and I had more time and I could work it with you and we went back and forth, we'd eventually come up with two main reasons, right? Intrinsic and extrinsic reasons. Intrinsic are all self-motivated. I want to get it done. Extrinsic, my parents are making me. But both of those reasons, if you even ask parents, why do you want your kids to get straight A's? They're going to tell you some version of, they want to build a competitive advantage for my kid. I want them to get in a good school. I want them to have more opportunities. I want them to have a better life. And once you wrap your head around that straight A 4.0 students across America and around Anchorage are building straight A's and weighted 4.0s in order to build a competitive advantage, you have to ask yourself this in a reflective way as a community. Then why are 3-point, 2-point, and 1-point students showing up? See, they don't look at life the same way. See, many, if not all, straight A 4.0 students are showing up because they view education as their solution, and they're working hard every day to build a competitive advantage. Far too many 3s, 2s, and 1-points view education as their problem, and they're just trying to survive it. We have to build the compelling relevance and purpose for young learners today at all different education levels, across the board. I advocate for everything. I advocate for four-year universities. I advocate for two-year community and technical colleges. I advocate for certifications, licensures, apprenticeship, military, entrepreneurship. Everything needs to be on the table today for young people because learners are looking at life differently today than in previous. I was invited in Canton, Ohio. 15 school superintendents brought me in to speak to 2,500 of their freshmen. They pooled them all together, and this was back in September. Now, when you're speaking to freshmen in September, they're 4 weeks into their high school experience. So they're old middle school kids and very young high school kids. And they asked me to speak, and when I speak to, and I speak every year to tens of thousands of middle school, high school, and college kids. And I give a speech that's 45 minutes long called Building Your Personal Competitive Advantage. And I give that speech followed by 15 to 30 minutes open dialogue and a Q&A session. And you have not lived in America until you've done an open dialogue with middle school kids. It's special at a level. You should try it. But I want to tell you how I address kids because I hold them scope locked for 45 minutes, not because I'm a good speaker. I'm actually, a lot of you think of me now seeing me, Mark must be an extrovert. Nope, I'm an introvert. I can't wait for this to be over. I can't wait to go and get on my Alaskan Airlines, thank you Alaska Airlines, flight this evening and head back to Phoenix for all the obvious reasons. But here's the deal, is that I'm talking to these kids and I can hold them scope locked. I wanna paint a picture because I'm gonna give you the first 60 to 90 seconds of what I talk about to kids. Because my outcome is always this, everywhere I go, no matter how old the audience, middle school, high school, or college, it's the same result. I can hold 95% of them completely silent, leaned in, scope locked for 45 minutes. The other 5% are sleeping. I'm not a miracle worker. Some kids are dealing with amazing stuff in their life, and sometimes they just need to close their... You put them in a performing arts center with the lights at 50, done. But I understand that. But here's what I do. So we did it over 2 days. We did a morning and an afternoon session over 2 days. I had anywhere from 400 to 1,000 split up in those four sessions. And I engineered the whole thing. If you could imagine this happening almost in this room, but it was a performing arts center. I engineered it so that everybody came through the same set of double doors in the back. I am a firm believer in building human connection with people. And I met a bunch of you today before we started because I love meeting the audience. So I stood in the back as they came off buses and they started filing in. And I stood there and I said some variation of good morning, good afternoon, I'm your speaker, great that you're here, whatever. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but it's the most soul-sucking thing I've ever done in my career. Because 95% of those kids completely ignored me as if I didn't exist. In order to make the 5% that acknowledged me, all you had to do walking by me was go, as if to say, human. That was it. And so they came in, they sat down. Now, I want to give you the result before I give you the opening of what I talk about and how I get them scope locked, because it's how I frame the power of what we're doing in that session. And this is the way we have to frame education differently in America today. We don't need to change curriculum. What we need to do is change simply how we frame the power of what they're building every day. Because if they're building just academic knowledge, there aren't enough kids who are buying into getting high academic knowledge. We have to buy into what they're building at all levels of education experience. And so what typically happens is I speak for 45, we do the open dialogue, I stand back at the doors as they leave, complete opposite. 95% of kids are fist bumps, high fives, handshakes, and hugs that they ask for, and pictures if they have cameras. How do I get that result? Happens in the introduction. Here it is, from my heart. This isn't memorized, I always do it from my heart. I will never be funny with kids. It's a non-starter. If you try to be funny and it doesn't land, you're done. Worse, you land it, and they think it's hysterically funny, it takes 3 to 4 minutes to get them to calm down. So it's a non-starter. I'm candid and frank, and here is exactly what I say, first words out of my mouth. I'm not here to entertain you today, though some things may be entertaining, and I'm not here to inspire you today, though some things may be inspiring. I am here in a candid, frank way to take you backstage behind the curtain to where the world has completely changed. It is now important for all of us, myself included, that we must all build our own personal competitive advantage in order to be able to build whatever lifestyle we see for ourselves down the road. So no matter what your view of life is down the road, no matter how grand, modest, or laid back you view that down the road, and it could be next week, month, year, decade, the rest of your life, where you want to live, how you want to live, the experiences you want to have, the friends you want to build, whatever that view is, it is now important for you as it is for me to build a personal competitive advantage to achieve it. And in 45 minutes, I'm going to define it. I'm going to give you the cheat codes, hacks, and shortcuts to do this in your life. Scope locked. I built a compelling relevance. We can do this in classrooms across America. We can do it because it simply frames what are you building today. We have to recognize that there's something else at play in all of this. Hands down, in America, and I've written about this, you can be wildly successful in America with a weighted 4.6 grade point average, but you could be wildly successful in America with a 2.5. You can also be a tremendous failure with a 4.6 weighted grade point average in America, and you can be a tremendous failure with a 2.5. So what's the difference? It's in the technical and the professional and life skills you build alongside that work in harmony with the academic knowledge that you have. I'm gonna ask you a question. I've got a lot of employers and educators and parents in the room today. How many of you as employers, if you were all wearing an employer hat today, how many of you, by a show of hands, would take someone either directly out of high school or college or training program with a 2.5 grade point average, but they could pass a drug test, they have critical thinking and problem solving abilities, they can communicate, they understand active listening and how to do conflict resolution. How many of you would take that person right now? Yeah, I get 100% of audiences that raise their hand to this. Then why are we promoting just straight A's and high academic achievement? We absolutely need high academic achievement in this world. We have to have it. Our economy demands it. We need more of the right kids going to four-year universities because there are thousands of careers and occupations that support our general economy. But we need more of the right kids going to two-year community and technical colleges for associate's degrees. We need more of the right kids getting certifications and licensures and apprenticeship in the military, entrepreneurship, et cetera. Everything needs to be on the table, and we have to be able to build those connections. When I speak about young people across America, I call them the Y generation, W-H-Y generation, because my friends, they need an answer to that question for everything they do. This may be an aha moment, it is when I travel the nation, but when you ask a young person in your sphere of influence to do something and they look back at you and they say, why should I do it that way? Most of us take that as a smart aleck response. We, of course, give the all-American response back, which is, you have played this game before. Here's the aha. They don't mean it as a smart aleck response. What they're really saying to you is, why do we do it this way? Because there has to be a better way to do this. There has to be a way to use Google something. There has to be a way to put it in the cloud. There has to be a way to get a bigger impact. And yet we cut their knees out from underneath them and we don't give them the opportunity to try. See, I think differently about young people. I don't think in negative terms like they're lazy and entitled. I think they're the most extraordinary generations to come down the pike. I think they're the most intelligent, resourceful, and pit bull-like generations we've ever seen in this country. When they see something they want, they'll move heaven and earth to get to that want to. Our challenge as parents, educators, and employers is getting them to want something. That's where the battlefield of the future is. And we have to be able to connect these dots. Let me tell you how this has played out in my own home. I have been a full-time single dad for 28 years. I've raised two sons 100% of my own. They're 2 years apart. And it's amazing to me that you can dip into the same gene pool twice and come up with two totally different human beings. Please raise your hand if you've done that here in Anchorage. Yeah, see, it's totally a thing. My youngest son, Nick, bears on our conversation today. I simply want to share with you a little bit about my son, Nick. My son hated going to school every day. I got to back you up to 16 years old, halfway through sophomore year of high school. If you were to ask my son, Nick, what are you passionate about? He'd say, I'm passionate about not going to school. He missed the maximum number of days of freshman year, maximum number of days of sophomore year, and he was sport. And by the way, he could throw up on cue. That was impressive in the morning. It was unbelievable. And he was sporting a 1.5 cumulative grade point average. He was failing by every metric known in education today until the day he walked into a programming and software development class just to scope it out. Just really fast, just to scope it out. He came home after 30 minutes, and we had the following conversation in our kitchen. I was making dinner. He was sitting across the aisle and started benign enough. I said, how'd it go today? He said, Dad, I know what I want to do with the rest of my life. Oh, dear Lord. For those of you that are parents in the room, there's no scarier phrase you can hear from your son or daughter than I know what I want to do with the rest of my life, because you realize whatever comes out of their mouth next is either something to applaud or something to start talking them out of. So I immediately put my dad hat on. I started asking some simple questions. Like the first question had to be, what exactly is a software engineer? I mean, I knew what it was. I wanted to see if he did, and he did. I asked Dad had question number two, which simply needed to be, well, how much money can you make doing that? Dad's, that's a big question. And he knew the answer, $120,000 to $200,000 a year. Said, thumbs up. I had to ask Dad had question number three. Well, what's the pathway for that? Like, how are you going to become a software engineer? He said, well, first I'm going to have to graduate high school. Thank you, God. Because the words graduate high school had never come out of his mouth before. He said, I'm going to have to graduate high school. I'm going to have to get a 4-year degree in computer science. I'm going to have to get some work experience. And then I'm going to have to go back and get a master's degree. 12 hours earlier, he was throwing up to avoid going to school tonight. He needs a master's degree. I said, this is what you're going to do? He said, yeah, I'm going to do this. I said, come on, you're going to do that. He said, I'm doing this. Nick graduated high school with a 2.5 cumulative grade point average, went to take the ACT, scored a 32. He got a scholarship, to Akron University, where he completed a 4-year computer science degree in 4 years. A month before he graduated, he had two job offers from two international software firms, both at $50,000 apiece. He took one. He's changed jobs several times and several promotions along the way. Today, he makes north of $90,000 a year working for AmTrust Financial in downtown Cleveland, Ohio, as a software engineering apprentice. He is independent, he is self-reliant, and he and his girlfriend take every dollar they make and travel to every Comic-Con they can get to anywhere in North America. And he loves to do cosplay and dress up as some weird female anime character because he simply thinks it's funny. That's my boy. Yep, that's my boy. On the day Nick came home and said, I know what I want to do with the rest of my life, was the day he went from a dad-driven life to a Nick-driven life. And the Nick-driven life was way easier on Dad's driven life. But it was on that day that he embodied this phrase, and I want you to leave with it today, and it's simply this, that if the want-to is strong enough, the how-to will come. His want-to to become a software engineer was so strong, he figured out how to start doing his homework and actually turn it in. So it turns out you have to do both of those things. He figured out how to get out of high school, how to get into college, how to get out of college, how to get his first job, second job, promotions along the way. He has figured out to live life on his terms, and we have to connect the dots for our young people and help them find the want to. When I speak to young people, I tell them that they are in the want to business to determine how they're going to figure out what are the things that are possible and how can they step forward to do those. I talked about the light at the end of the tunnel when I started with my opening remarks, and I said there were two critical things, right? What does career and lifestyle look like at the light at the end of their tunnel? The tunnel, that's the time they spend in education, workforce development, and all the work needed. But I simply want to share with you this. I'm going to ask you a question in Anchorage. I want you to give me an enthusiastic answer. Everybody in this room, you're just going to know. I'm going to ask you two questions, one word answers. Here we go. But there's an aha on the other side of it. Between the words lifestyle and career, which one of those words is most important to young people today?
Lifestyle.
What do we spend all our time talking to them about?
Career.
Every decision a young person in America makes is based on how it affects their lifestyle. Careers become a lifestyle decision. The aha is this. If you want to start any substantive career conversation with anyone in your sphere of influence, don't start with career, start with lifestyle. Two questions I love to ask the young people in my sphere of influence: what do you love to do and what do you do well? What do you love to do and what do you do well? Because the answer to those two questions will lead to a myriad of follow-up questions that you can now build relevance to a career conversation. You can do this in your home, in your classrooms, in your place of business. Recognize young people today, 30 and younger, do things differently than older generations. They do zero on faith. Previous generations, millennials, Xers, boomers, did things on faith. Young people today do zero on faith. They need a compelling relevance and purpose to guide their actions. And if there is no relevance and purpose, they're going to avoid doing it. And we have to connect those dots. I was invited to speak at Harvard University. It was a crowning achievement in my life to be invited to speak at Harvard because, frankly, my friends, full disclosure, in high school, I was in the half of the class that made the top half possible. You guys did the math on that really good, especially after that dessert I see on the tables. I spoke to governors, lieutenant governors, K-12 statewide superintendents, chancellors of community college systems, and Fortune 100 top executives, and I spoke about the notion that we're making kids college and career ready in this country. Perhaps you've heard that phrase. Came down from the federal government a little over 2.5 decades ago, and it has taken such a root in our country that it's become the tagline for some districts in America. ABC School District, making kids college and career ready. And I spoke about how much I love the phrase. You have to love it. It sounds noble, sounds like low-hanging fruit. I mean, if we're gonna do something in America, gosh darn, we should be making kids college and career ready. Makes complete sense, except for one problem with the phrase. Almost no one in America reads the word "and" in between the word college and the word career. For 2.5 decades, we have read it as it's the only pathway for success, that everything else is an also-ran. So what I spoke about to a standing ovation that day was that I don't think we should be making kids college and career ready in this country. I don't. I think we should be making them career ready, period. Sure, all kinds of wonderful careers and occupations go through four-year universities and baccalaureates, masters, PhDs, MDs, JDs, et cetera. I'm a tremendous fan of a four-year degree and beyond in America. There are extraordinary things that we need in our general economy, but if you're gonna go to that level of education, you need to invest wisely, go with passion, go with purpose, but make sure you get it done. That's not what's happening in too many parts of America today. Far too many kids are dropping out for a myriad of different reasons, and they're not getting what we promised them at that level of education. Because there's also wonderful careers and occupations, a two-year community in technical colleges through associate's degrees, wonderful careers and occupations through certifications and licensures and apprenticeship in the military and entrepreneurship. Why, with so many ways to be successful, do we tout one way as the main way? We need to open it up because it opens up our communities in order to be able to allow students, you know, whether 4.6, whether 3.5, 2.5, to build the skills necessary to build a competitive advantage, because they're the ones who come out and stay in our local communities. And it's important that we reframe and understand the power of all this. I'm going to share with you some quick numbers, and I want to do it just to spur some reflection as you see these things. And I've written Forbes articles about all of these different things you're about to see. It may look like, you know, wow, our four-year university isn't getting the job done. That's not what this is meant to be. Our four-year universities are doing extraordinary work. They are doing yeoman's work in a changing world to build the connections and the abilities for students to succeed in every way, shape, and form. But we've got some things that we need to consider moving forward. The first of these is that according to Georgetown University Center for Education and Workforce, they estimate that a third of the nation's top performing high school students with SATs over 1,000 do not obtain a college degree, yet nearly all of them attempt college. Are these not the people we say are suited to go on to higher education? A question I ask around America, just reflectively. Why do we assume in America that just because someone's good at school, they should get more school? I'm not saying they shouldn't, but I'm saying, why is it a lock they should? According to the Strata Gallup Education Network, they did a study of 32,000 full-time four-year university students at 43 random tier one universities and found that only one-third of those students believe they'll be successful in the job market and workplace. Only half believe their major will even lead to a good job, which begs the question, why are you there? Because we said to go. Wall Street Journal, 40% of all college students drop out. Of the 60% that earn a degree in 6 years, 20% will end up chronically underemployed. This means for every five students, only two will graduate and find a job based on their degree. Simply where we are, percentage of students who enrolled in college is at an all-time historic low. 3 million fewer students in colleges today than there were just 3 short years ago. We've hit the first 3 years of a projected 12 to 15 year enrollment cliff in higher education. Some of that is based on population, some of it's based on value proposition and cost to play. And all of these things are factoring out in our communities, and 2/3 of high school kids see no value in getting a degree and they think they'll be just fine. College debt in America, just as a backdrop. The one that bothers me is the second one, is that $176 billion or 11% is more than 90 days in default, and they're still paying on it. Etiquette gap. I wrote this at Forbes. According to Intelligent.com, they did a survey of managers, directors, and executives involved in hiring, and found this. Recent college graduates, at the interview, 53% struggled with good eye contact. 50% asked for unreasonable compensation, 47% dressed inappropriately, 27% used inappropriate language. One of my favorites, 21% refused to turn on their camera during a virtual interview. Seems like low-hanging fruit, doesn't it? My personal favorite, 19% brought a parent to the interview. Absolutely. This is what I was in Lake Charles, Louisiana just recently. I was doing an economic development. I had like 250 employers in the room. I got to the bottom of this, and the CEO of a statewide ambulance company said, "Perna, your numbers are low." I'm like, here's where we are. I want to underpin the conversation we need to have with kids, and as a backdrop, I simply want to use this biomedical science program at two high schools in North Phoenix, K-12 system of about 38,000 kids. Simple concept. This is a 6-foot-wide by 4-foot-high interactive wall graphic. Don't worry, I'm going to zoom in. Simple concept, but it underpins the conversation we need to have with young people so that it shows what's possible at all levels of education experience, so we can get more students in all the right areas so that they can be successful, we can complete them, and they become part of our community. So this 2-year course of study at this biomedical science program is the trunk of a tree. The trunk leads to a branch system. Branch system represents all the careers and occupations that are possible. That simple. So when you graduate high school and you've completed this program in high school, you now unlock the entry-level career area. Entry-level is not synonymous with low pay. Simply means you can go do those things in North Phoenix right now. It creates a connection that is right there in the community. A large part of why communities across America have too many young people leaving to go somewhere else is because they don't know exactly how they can stay here. They don't know what's possible because they're not seeing the big picture and we're not bringing it to complete relevance. And so, but if you want to unlock the middle part of the tree, that's just additional education and experience. Maybe it's completing an associate's degree, completing an apprenticeship. There's some kind of additional specialized education, maybe just experience that unlocks that level. But at the top of the tree, that's the professional careers, and that's with your 4-year degrees, master's, PhDs, MDs, JDs, specialized training, etc. But what it tells young people is here are all the different ways you can be successful and fit into this community so that at all levels of education and experience, now everything is on the table. You're now building a competitive advantage to build the academic, technical, and professional and life skills necessary to thrive at any level of education experience. We have now looked at everything so that we can tell this story. This is Santa Clarita, California, College of the Canyons. Simply the same thing in all of their academic disciplines with the ability to tell a very powerful story of how you can connect the dots from industry to industry. I was in Davenport, Iowa. The executives at John Deere, agricultural company that makes construction and agricultural equipment, invited me to visit their advanced manufacturing facility. And I was visiting them just a couple of years ago. Here's me walking in on my tour. I ran into this impressive young woman. Her name's Megan. She's 24 years old. She'd been there for 5 years. And when I meet impressive young people, I like to ask a pretty simple question. How did you get here? She started telling me her story. She said, "I was a sophomore at Davenport West High School. I was a straight-A student. I was on the honor roll, and I was in band and chorus." And she said, "I was living the dream. Came time to register for classes junior year. Decided I wanted to take a welding class." Yeah, Megan's a welder. Megan took the first class, liked it so much, she took the second, third, fourth, got all her certifications. Upon graduating high school with academic excellence, I might add, she decided she immediately wanted to go to work upon graduating high school with John Deere as a welder. John Deere, to their infinite wisdom, hired Megan. She worked there for 12 months when she took John Deere up on what they offer every employee, which is if you've worked here for 12 months, we will now pay 2/3 of your higher education. She immediately went to get a 4-year degree in business. John Deere paid for 2/3 of it. She, of course, paid the other 1/3 pretty easily. Why? She makes great money. She's a welder. So now, at 24 years old, 5 years with John Deere, this impressive young woman has an extraordinary competitive advantage. She's got robust academic knowledge, technical competencies, and professional skills. She also has a 4-year degree in business. Her college debt, zero. She found an unconventional way to get where she wants to go and have someone pay for most of it. She has now gone from an hourly worker to a salaried worker. It would not surprise me one bit if this impressive young woman one day is managing a 2.2 million square foot facility for John Deere. My friends, hear me loud and clear, because here's where we are in America today. It matters significantly less where you start after high school. It only matters where you end up. How many of us know someone that would have tried to talk an impressive female straight A student out of taking welding? How many of us know someone who tried to talk my son Nick with a 1.5 grade point average and an attendance problem out of wanting to go to college? Right? Because clearly my son was one of those kids. My friends, there's no such thing as those kids. They're all just kids in varying degrees of figuring life out. We tend to applaud those that figure it out early and look at those that haven't figured it out yet and wonder what's wrong with them. They just haven't seen, felt, smelled, touched, and experienced what's possible yet. And we have to recognize that that becomes important. Our call to action is simply this: we have to connect, engage, and answer why for the young people in our sphere of influence by helping them create a strong message of value and purpose in what happens in this community. Because sure, they can go do it in the lower 48, but they can do it right here in Anchorage or in Alaska. And those opportunities abound at all levels of education experience. It's a powerful story. But we have to rally our community. Doing the things you're doing here, my hat is off to you. As an economic development engine for Anchorage and beyond, this is an extraordinary gathering of people pulling in the same direction and recognizing that you have to be able to build consensus. We collaborate around America all the time. We reach consensus almost never. Consensus starts in this room by recognizing that building a rally point that connects the dots for kids from education into local employment at all levels of education experience raises all ships to the top based on their unique interests, talents, and abilities. You have the ability to do it. You are community leaders and civic leaders in this community. The fact that you're here is astounding in order to be able to move forward. Get past what you need to get past, bring it together, you know, everything from working with employers and with educators, more job shadowing, internships, apprenticeships, mentorships, bring this to life for kids and the game's over. When I was in a tree when I was 10 years old, when I was a kid, I was up 28 to 30 feet. I'll never forget this as long as I live. I felt pretty comfortable. I moved away from the trunk. I'm at a perilous height. I'm surveying the world around me. Felt pretty comfortable. I'd been there before. When all of a sudden the limb underneath me cracked. Can you imagine the oh, four-letter expletive feeling you get right here? Three things happened at that moment. One, I became singularly focused, right? Didn't matter what stresses and challenges I had getting in the tree, didn't matter who I thought was cute at school. Second thing that happened is I started strategic planning. How am I gonna get out of this? How am I gonna get back to the safety trunk? Where am I gonna fall? How am I gonna get back to this, right? Third thing that happened is I took action, and I submit to you that I took massive action. And all three of those things, focus, plan, action, literally happened in the blink of an eye. I believe that the branch creaks in our lives many times. Anytime there's a fear of loss or a sense of urgency, the branch creaks a little bit, and it forces all of us to focus, to plan, and to take action. I'm going to give you an example from my own life. When I was 34 years old, I had the worst year of my life. I will never forget this. I hope you never have a year like this, but when I was 34, I was forced to file bankruptcy due to a failed business venture I'd started 5 years earlier. My bad, my fault, went belly up. And I don't know if you've ever had a failure like that. Failure, being defeated, yeah, all that's great. But the thing that gets you for years is you're ashamed and embarrassed it happened at all. That same year, I went through a divorce, became a full-time single dad of two boys. That same year, because of the bankruptcy, I was forced to take a job where I wasn't making enough money each month to support the three of us. I don't know if any of you have ever had too much month at the end of the money, but that's a tough spot to be in, right? We lived like that for several years, and I also weighed over 400 pounds. My branch was creaking literally, emotionally, psychologically. I will never forget this. I remember sitting down in our very modest circumstances, and looking out the window and thinking to myself, man, Mark, if things are gonna change, you're gonna need to change, and if things are gonna get better, you're gonna need to get better. And it was at that moment that I focused, planned, and took action in my life because I felt and heard the branch creaking in my life. And over the next 13 months, I lost 175 pounds. I've managed to keep it off. During that same time period, I started this company. And in the span of 28 years, I've gone from the worst moments you can imagine to today. I almost can't believe where I am. But I'll tell you this, I was afraid to write a book because I was not a good student in high school. I didn't think I could write a book anybody would buy. And I went through this entire process where I changed my philosophy in life 10 years ago. My philosophy was this: I found that I'm better in my life when I'm uncomfortable. And I love speaking to kids about this because we seem to have an economy today built on comfort. And I love being comfortable as much as you love being comfortable, because you know what? Being comfortable is great, but almost no growth happens when you're comfortable. It happens when, in fact, you step outside your comfort zone. So I realized 10 years ago that I needed to step outside my comfort zone, and I, in fact, needed to be comfortable being uncomfortable. How did I do it? Here's my philosophy in life. Changed everything for me. Say yes, then figure out how. Everybody usually does all the research to figure out before they say yes to something. If I think it's worthwhile, I'll say yes first, and I'll figure out, thank God, or I would not be standing in front of you today. Because if I would have known it was going to take me 18 months, 23 versions, 12 months to get a publisher, and that the day before it all came out eventually, that I was going to be sad and depressed the day before it came out in 179 airport stores, Barnes & Nobles, four countries, all the formats, sad and depressed. Why? Because all I could think was negative terms. No one's going to read this. No one's going to care. I wasted 27 months of my life doing this. I had no idea the next day it would become a number one bestseller. I had no idea it would go on to win 8 national book awards. I didn't even know there were book awards. I don't share any of this to impress you. I share it to impress upon you. It is the moment the branch creaks in our lives when we are finally willing to focus, to plan, and to take action. The branch creak moment is the want to. If the want to is strong enough, the how to will come. The day my son Nick came home and said, I know what I want to do with the rest of my life, was the day his branch was creaking. It was on that day that he was euphoric for about 2 or 3 hours, but eventually came downstairs 3 hours later with the OMG look and emoji on his face, because he came to the realization, OMG, I need a master's degree and I have a 1.5 grade point average. He focused, he planned, he took action. My friends, we can do this as communities. We need to recognize the power of that. But I'm going to leave you with this. It's my favorite movie line of all time. It's from the movie Apollo 13. And in the movie Apollo 13, right at the beginning of the movie, it's July 20th, 1969, Tom Hanks playing Commander Jim Lovell and his wife are throwing a party at their Houston home to celebrate the fact that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are walking on the moon for the very first time. My line happens at the end of the night. Guests have all gone home. Beer cans strewn all over the backyard. And Tom Hanks looks at the moon, looks at his wife, casually says these words. He says, you know what? From now on, we live in a world where man has walked on the moon. It wasn't a miracle. We just decided to go. I find these to be the most powerful words of hope I've ever heard in my life, because to understand the power of these words, you have to back up to May 25th, 1961, where John F. Kennedy stands up before a joint session of Congress and later at Rice University and says the words many of us have heard before: I commit this nation by the end of this decade that we will land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. We do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard. That speech came only 20 days after Alan Shepard made the first U.S. manned space launch. Lasted all of 15 minutes, and yet we laid out a broad goal where hundreds of thousands of Americans worked tirelessly to make that dream come true. It wasn't a miracle. We just decided to go. I share this with you for this reason. The things you are doing at this meeting, the things you are doing in this community, the things we just spoke about for 40 minutes are all possible. It takes a community of people pulling in the same direction to create the pipelines that are necessary. It does not take a miracle to do this. You simply have to make a decision to go. My friends, thank you so much for all you do. It has been an honor to be with you. I wish you Godspeed. God bless you all. Thank you so much for being a part of this today. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for Addressing Alaskans. Today's show came from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's 2026 Economic Forecast Luncheon. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ammon Swenson. Thanks for listening.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.